in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm Jonathan Strickland, and today joining me in the studio is Joe McCormick. Joe, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Thank you.
It was kind of a last minute jump in.
It was. Originally, Lauren Vogelbaum was going to sit in on this one, but Lauren's feeling a little under the weather, and we just wanted to look back at the year 2014, some of the big stories that happened, stuff that I didn't cover in the predictions episode because we didn't know it was going to happen, and then it happened. That's kind of the way that tends to work.
I think your crystal ball is faulty.
Yeah, it turns out that I was actually just staring into a magic eight ball, and that was it.
I think the problem is that you're not actually using crystal. You've been peering into a plutonium core.
That would also explain the loss in teeth. So at any rate, let's talk about some of the big stories in 2014. Some of the stuff that happened throughout the year. Now, we're just going to be kind of covering some interesting things. Not everything, obviously.
The highlights and the lowlights.
Yeah, nothing like every story, what happened in 2014. It would take us way too long.
You know, 2014, I think, has been a really interesting year for tech. And one of the most interesting things about it to me is that it seems like this has really been the year of the hack.
That is absolutely the way I would put it.
Yeah, I mean, there have been big hacks and security breaches in the past,
sure.
But 2014, there were so many of them and with such far-ranging impact that I think it was the year where the average person out there, the person who doesn't really follow technology news, is really starting to understand that a lot of the conflicts that are looming large in our future are going to be technology and cybersecurity related conflicts.
Yeah, you know, we've heard stories in the past, everything from discovery of code in infrastructure, things like utility infrastructure that showed that there was possible Chinese incursions into our infrastructure. You know, those stories have come and gone, but this year really has displayed it. I mean, there have been a lot that have directly impacted consumers. Of course, in 2013, there was the Target hack, the one that stole a whole bunch of credit card information as well as other stuff from Target. Mm-hmm. And the fallout of that continued into 2014. But there are a lot of other stories. We're going to touch on some of them that involve hackers hitting different sites.
Yeah. Well, in fact, maybe we should just go through all the stories of the year chronologically, because it looks like in your notes, Jonathan, the very first thing you have is about a hack.
No, it is, in fact. That was that hackers who posted data about Snapchat users claimed they did so to show that Snapchat security wasn't sufficient.
Was this in January of this year?
Yeah, it was. This is the first story we have. So the hack itself had happened toward the tail end of 2013, but this was where we started getting information about what the hackers say their motivation happened to be. So, you know, there are different types of hackers, and I've talked about this before. There are hackers who, what they're interested in is just learning how a system works and then how to modify that system. Has nothing to do with breaching security, right? It's just learning how something works, being able to build it yourself, maybe modify it, maybe make it do something it wasn't intended to do. But it has nothing necessarily nefarious about it. Then you've got things like white hat hackers versus black hat hackers. White hat hackers are the ones who work with companies to test their security, and they'll try to breach that security and then explain to the company how they were able to do it so that they can patch that vulnerability. Black hat hackers are the ones that are trying to do it for some sort of gain, either an ideological gain where they are bringing down a company or organization that has a philosophy that doesn't agree with their own philosophy, or monetary gain where they're stealing stuff either to directly benefit themselves or to sell off to other people. So in this case, the hackers were saying, we were just trying to prove that this company that says it has your privacy at heart doesn't really protect your privacy. That's all we were trying to do. But the way they did it was perhaps a little more on the black hat side than the white hat. It's not like they alerted Snapchat and said, hey, by the way, we discovered this vulnerability, you need to address it. Instead, they actually attacked. So,
was this at all related to the fact that Snapchat, I think it was Snapchat, that they were claiming that they delete all of your messages,
yes,
but they actually don't?
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there were a lot of issues with that Snapchat. Because again, like you were pointing out, Snapchat is all about sending someone a message that's supposed to have kind of a self-destruct element to it. So that
it's supposed to be ephemeral and not leave a trail for future generations to come discover what, you know, grandma and grandpa were sending to each other on their phones.
Right. And it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, salacious. It often is, but it doesn't have to be. It could just be, I don't want this to live anywhere because it's just a goofy picture and I just thought it was funny and that's all. But yeah, it turned out that their promises of things being deleted exactly when you expected them to be were not completely true. The next story in January is that the U.S. Appeals Court struck down the FCC's 2011 regulations that demanded internet providers treat all traffic equally because the court said the FCC lacked the authority to enact the regulations in the first place.
Uh-oh. Yeah. Sounds like this is going to lead to some more net neutrality squabbles.
Yeah, this was a big, big deal. I mean, and a lot of people were pointing out that this was a potential issue at the very beginning, saying it's not that people were saying, I don't disagree that we need to have net neutrality rules in place. The problem is that the FCC is trying to exert authority over something it doesn't have authority over. And it was because of the classification of internet communications. We'll come back to this story toward the end of 2014. But yeah, that was a big news item early on. Also in January, Lenovo bought Motorola Mobility from Google for $3 billion. And meanwhile, Google bought Nest for $3.2 billion. Nest is the company that made
thermostat, right?
Yeah. It also did smoke detectors, which in 2014 it ended up having to recall because of some issues.
Okay. One sentence explanation. How is the Nest thermostat actually special?
Well, it learns your behaviors. So if you like to have your house nice and cool in the evening and warm and toasty in the morning, it learns that and then starts to preset things so you don't have to ever program it to do so. It just learns what you want. And can even do things like when it realizes there's no one in the house, it can start to turn things off so that way you're not wasting energy heating a house that has no one in it.
Okay.
Yeah. And the final story of January 2014 was that the Apple Mac turned 30. What year were you born, Joe?
Oh, the old 1986.
Okay, so the Mac is older than you are. The Apple Mac, I remember in 1984 when the commercial for the Apple Mac came out. That was the Orwellian one. You probably have seen it even.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, throwing the sledgehammer
down a hall. Yeah. She throws and shatters the screen.
Right.
Whose face is it up on the screen? Is it like John Hurt or somebody?
Something like that. Although if it was
it might not actually be a famous person.
I was about to say, if it was John Hurt, then John Hurt has remained old man age since 1984 and hasn't changed since. It's not that he stayed young. He's just stayed just as old.
No, actually, you know, I think I'm thinking of him as the big totalitarian face on the screen in, what's the movie?
Which movie?
V for Vendetta.
Oh, all right. Yeah.
Isn't it John Hurt?
I think you're right. I have never seen V for Vendetta.
Ah.
It's kind of odd, right? Because, I mean, that's...
Well, it's got from what I recall, it's got John Hurt talking into a big screen and, you know, spittles coming out of his mouth. He looks very angry about something.
He's being the big brother type character.
Yeah.
Well, in February 2014, that was when we got a big news item where Microsoft finally announced its new CEO. So Ballmer had stepped down as CEO.
No.
Yeah. No, that spoiler alert. Ballmer stepped down as CEO. Developers, I'm gone. And then Satya Nadella became the new CEO of Microsoft, and he was a veteran of the company. He had been there for 22 years. Bill Gates, meanwhile, transitioned from chairman of the Microsoft board to the role of technology advisor.
Hmm.
Microsoft's competitor, Sony, announced 5,000 job cuts and that they were going to split the TV division into a wholly owned subsidiary and to sell off its PC business. So this was a big news, and not the last time we'll talk about Sony in this podcast, obviously. Anyone who's aware of current news knows that we're going to have to come back around to Sony by the end.
Surely.
Also in that month, February 2014, the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory announced it had produced fusion power using high-powered lasers. And not only that, but they got more energy out of the fusion fuel than was put into the fusion fuel. That's a big deal.
Well, that would certainly be the goal if you're going to try to generate municipal energy off fusion.
Exactly. And that was a tough goal, right? It was one of those things where we can achieve fusion, but we're pouring so much energy to make the reaction happen that we're on a losing end of the proposition. Now, one thing to keep in mind, this does not mean that we're suddenly going to have fusion power plants everywhere, because the laser only reached about 1% of the fuel. So this is still a long way from becoming a new way of generating electricity. You got more energy out of it, but you were only able to consume a tiny portion of the actual fuel. So it's not an efficient system yet, but it's very encouraging. Now, in March 2014, we get another hacking story. Mt. Gox, G-O-X. you know why it's called Mt. Gox, right? You know what the story is behind that name?
I don't at all.
So Mt. Gox, if you were to spell out the first three letters, you got M-T for Mount, and then big uppercase G for Gox. Magic the Gathering. I know. I thought you would enjoy that, Joe.
It's so magical.
Yeah.
Well,
so,
wait, hold on. What does that have to do with Bitcoin?
Well, it was the world's largest Bitcoin exchange. Now,
No. I mean, what does Magic the Gathering have to do with Bitcoin?
You can buy a crap ton of Magic the Gathering cards with some Bitcoin, my friend.
Are you going to tell me that Magic the Gathering cards are going to be the successor to Bitcoin as the next cryptocurrency?
I would say that there was definitely a bartering system with Magic the Gathering cards for a good long while before Bitcoin came around. But obviously, Magic the Gathering is not a digital format.
Hold on. You were going to tell me an event. What happened to Mt. Gox?
It got hacked, dude.
Another hack.
Yeah. In this case, this was a true hack. This was not a DDoS attack. This was the real deal. And the exchange completely collapsed because 750,000 bitcoins belonging to Mt. Gox customers, as well as 100,000 bitcoins belonging to the exchange itself, were stolen in that hack.
Now, I may be misremembering, but I thought that the idea of Bitcoin was sold as an unhackable solution.
You are correct, sir. The idea was that it had security measures in place that would prevent you from being able to do something like spend the same Bitcoin more than once. Because
mm-hmm.
that's obviously a concern with any digital format. Obviously, if I give you a digital file, let's say it's a music file, and you think this song's pretty awesome, I'd like to share this with all my friends, you could copy it as many times as you wanted and send as many copies as you wanted to everyone. Or you could upload a copy and everyone else could end up grabbing that copy from the cloud and they all have a copy of that song. What happens when your money is in this format? But Bitcoin is supposed to be made in such a way that it's impossible to steal. It's impossible to spend more than one Bitcoin, or it's impossible to spend the same Bitcoin more than once at a time. I mean, unless it eventually made its way back to you, but it's a little complex the way the Bitcoin transactions work. At any rate, the people behind Bitcoin were saying this was due to faulty security at Mt. Gox. It had nothing to do with the format of the Bitcoins themselves. They were, it was like saying you can't fault a dollar for being stolen from a bank. Like if thieves come into a bank and they breach a bank's security, it's not the fault of the currency within it.
Oh, okay. Well, then, I mean, that doesn't really matter to the average person using Bitcoin.
No, it doesn't.
Their stuff can still be hacked.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, that was the problem, was that the bottom issue is that this exchange still collapsed. And another one, a smaller one called Flexcoin, just a week later, also went belly up after being targeted and thieves attacked them and stole bitcoins from them. So for a while, people were wondering if this was going to be the beginning of the end of the cryptocurrency, but it stuck around. So spoiler alert for later in the year. Also in March, Edward Snowden addressed the South by Southwest Interactive Conference via streaming, because he's still a wanted man, to talk about the need for better encryption systems in the era of digital surveillance.
You don't say.
Yeah. He's saying, hey, look, here's the deal. People are spying on you one way or the other. Maybe it's a company. Maybe it's a government. Maybe it's hackers. But people are looking at your stuff. They might not be actively looking at your stuff. They might be gathering your stuff, and then one day down the road, they might look
at it. For a rainy day.
Exactly. It could be one of those things where someone gets this notion to search for a particular search term, and it pulls up all interactions between people who use that search term in some way. Maybe you're one of those people. So maybe what we need to do is really look at some good ways to encrypt communication so that only the person only the people communicating are the ones who have access to that info. So it was a very interesting thing that he was actually virtually at South by Southwest. Also in March, IBM showed off the power of artificial intelligence at South by Southwest using a food truck in which the cooks prepared food based off recipes made by an artificially intelligent program.
Huh.
Yeah. Users would put in.
I did not read about this at the time.
It's kind of silly, but users would put in a few preferences about what they liked as food. The program would then essentially had a database of recipes, and based upon your preferences would suggest something interesting based on that. And then the cooks, the human cooks inside the food truck, would actually make your meal. So it's not like a robot was cooking your food. It was just choosing what it was you were going to eat. And obviously it couldn't be.
I would love to see all the ways that went wrong.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how well it did.
Why did you put cinnamon sticks on this pizza?
Yeah, right. There was certainly not an unlimited choice, obviously. They were limited to whatever things they could prepare in that food truck. But it was an interesting approach. And, you know, just showing that Watson can win at Jeopardy as well as cook you a decent meal. The United States government in March asked the Internet Corporation for assigned names and numbers, that's called ICANN, to come up with a transition plan for the U.S. to relinquish control of the Internet. So this was essentially saying, when I say control of the Internet, I really mean the whole naming convention, being in charge of all that kind of stuff. That all fell under the purview of the U.S.
Does that originally go back to DARPA?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I know the Internet does, but the naming conventions.
Well, yeah, because it was the founders of, essentially, it was the people working on ARPANET who came up with the protocols that the Internet would end up following. And it was through their work that the rules were set. Like, this is how we name things. And it kind of evolved from there. So it's more like the roots of this can be traced back to DARPA. Maybe not a direct line in the sense of it was exactly the same way. But yes, it certainly does go back there. And in March, that's when Sony announced Project Morpheus, which is a VR headset, kind of a competitor to the Oculus Rift. Mm-hmm. Although the Oculus Rift has been, is being developed just for computer systems, not for consoles, whereas the Morpheus would presumably work with the PlayStation.
Now, wait a minute. Did Sony buy the Oculus Rift?
No, Facebook did.
Facebook, that's right.
Yeah. Facebook bought Oculus, which was a big, you know, that was a big head scratcher for a lot of people saying, well, this is kind of weird. And it was one of those things that
experience 360 degrees of annoying people on your newsfeed.
It was also what caused the Mojang founder, Notch, the guy who created Minecraft, to say, well, that means Minecraft's not coming to the Oculus Rift, because he didn't like Facebook at all.
All right.
He later said that maybe he was being a little reactionary, but he was just like, I don't like Facebook's privacy policies. I don't like how they make, you know, they make people their product. And I'm not crazy about developing Minecraft for them. So not that matters, but we'll get to that.
But so we've got another next generation VR headset in the works.
Yeah. Yeah. And
has anybody tried these out yet? I haven't read about this.
I've tried the Oculus Rift.
No. I mean the Morpheus.
Oh, no, it hasn't. It's still, I think, in the prototype stage.
Okay.
It hasn't been released yet. Have you tried a VR headset, like a recent one?
Not a recent one. Like, I tried one in the 90s.
Yeah, which,
when they were like pretty funny.
Yeah. The polygon pterodactyls and stuff. Yeah. Yeah, and I did that too. I tried an Oculus Rift for the first time. I've got a friend who works for Google. And he had an Oculus Rift developer kit. So I went over to his house and tried it out and was almost immediately completely disoriented and feeling sick to my stomach. So
nice.
I said, all right, I'm done with this. He's like, don't you want to try? And this was the program he gave me was literally you're walking around a villa in like, it's like a virtual villa in Italy. So you think like, and there's nothing going on. It's just you
no
walking
zombies
through,
or no, anything.
You're just walking through a villa. Like there's no mafia hits going on in the lawn, nothing like that. And so I did that, and just that alone was enough to make me feel a little like, ooh, I'm feeling a little swimmy, loosey goosey, weird. And part of it was because the control scheme, right? Like I could move my head and that would change my perspective, but I still had to use a controller to move around. And it was that disconnect that was causing some issues.
Right. So maybe if you had it with a, one of those in-place treadmills,
yeah,
the gaming treadmills.
Sure. That might have helped a little bit, but it was funny because he said, don't you want to try the space, ship game that I have that you can run? I'm like, no, do you want your computer to be covered in my lunch? Cause that's what's going to happen if we try that. So, but, moving on, we've got another hacker story for April 2014. That's when the Heartbleed bug is discovered in certain versions of the OpenSSL software, which is a secure socket layer software. It's meant to provide that secure, or what you assume is a secure, connection between your browser and some other website. So things like banking sites use this. Lots of sites use this. I mean, you know, if you see like HTTPS, that's a type of the secure software. Not everyone uses the specific type to do that, but it is one of the very popular ones. They discovered that in one version of it, there was this bug that could potentially allow attackers to access information that could include sensitive material. It all was information that was stored in random access memory. So it wasn't everything. It was just a certain number of characters. And the way it worked was that if I send you, let's say that we're going to represent, Joe, you and I, what happened with this Heartbleed bug. Okay.
I'm ready.
So I'm going to send out a message just to make sure you are listening to me. And you have to repeat back that message to me in order to prove that you are listening to me. And then everything's cool and we can keep on going. So when I send out that message to you, it is a certain number of characters long. Let's say it's 20 characters long. So you get it and you see that it's 20 characters long. So you know that's how long the message has to be. So you repeat the message. It's 20 characters long. Send it back to me. Now let's say I send you a message and it's 20 characters long, but the package says it's actually 500 characters long. Now you, being a dum-dum, can't tell the difference between 20 and 500. You see the 20 characters that are the beginning of this supposed 500 character message, but now there's all this empty space. So panicking, you just grab whatever happens to be nearby and you shove it at the end of the message. This is whatever happens to be in your random access memory. It's like short-term memory for people. Now, if we're talking about a service like a bank transaction, that information might include my password because I had to enter it to get into the system.
Right.
So you send in plain text back to me a message that has 20 characters of whatever it was I sent plus all this other information. So it meant that a hacker, if they got in the middle of this, could end up getting sensitive information like login information or other account information. Obviously a huge vulnerability, but somewhat reliant on the luck of the draw.
Yeah, well, it did in the end mean that almost everybody on the internet had changed some passwords.
Yeah, well, the scary thing was that people were saying, it doesn't, you know, you got to wait until the service upgrades their version of OpenSSL. Because if you just change your password before they've upgraded, the same thing can keep on happening to you. So it was truly scary. This is another one of those things that really drove it home to the consumer, at least people who are paying attention. It was truly scary because there wasn't a lot we as consumers could do. We had to depend upon other companies to do the right thing first, and then we could, end up changing our passwords as a result.
Right. And things like this matter, I think, because it's something that the consumer cannot be blamed for.
Yeah.
It's not something where it's just that the end user is not, you know, following best practices,
right,
is designing weak passwords or something like this. You can be doing everything right and still have all of your information threatened.
Yeah. It's one of the most frustrating parts about this kind of security vulnerability. It's that, you know, we already know there are all these things that people don't do on average. Like, they are not keeping enough strong passwords. But then they could look at these stories and say, look, it doesn't even matter if I do everything right.
Yeah.
It is a little frustrating. Also in April, 1 week after assuming the position of CEO of Mozilla, Brendan Eich stepped down because it had been revealed that he had donated money to a California ballot measure that was anti-gay marriage. And Mozilla's corporate values are focused on equal rights and free speech. So the corporate philosophy of the company and the personal philosophy of the new CEO were not at all in alignment. And there was an intense amount of pressure And so as a result, 1 week after becoming CEO, he stepped down, which, you know, that's an interesting story. Mozilla had a rough year, overall in 2014, but, that one really opened up my eyes when it happened. And, the next one is probably the most dramatic story of the year beyond these hacking stories. This is the one that took place in a desert. Alamogordo. I can say it eventually. Alamogordo, New Mexico. It's when excavators were digging and they discovered aliens.
No.
Well, cartridges of a game about an alien.
You're talking about E.T. for the Atari 2600.
E.T. the Extraterrestrial for the Atari 2600. Yes, I am. Yeah, this was the long, you know, held story, the belief that that these cartridges had been taken out to the desert and unceremoniously dumped.
No, I think it was not just this game, right? There
were
a lot of poorly performing games that were taken out there and dumped because they just thought, well, we're never going to sell all these.
Yeah, no, this was the days of the crash of 1983 of video games, the home gaming market.
When everyone suddenly realized home gaming is never going to be big.
The problem was it got too big too fast, right? The issue was that they had all these games that didn't have to go through any kind of quality check before they hit stores, and the market was flooded with a lot of crappy games, some of which came from big name companies because of one reason or another. The guy who created, the guy who programmed E.T. the Extraterrestrial also created one of the most, well-criticized games for the Atari 2600, Yar's Revenge. And it turns out that he was, you know, they gave him a very short timeline and a lot of money. And he says, all right. And so he made a game that the game he could make in that small amount of time. And, as a result, it is largely pointed at as one of the reasons for the video game crash. Truly, you want to get more specific. The problem was way more widespread than one bad title, or even two if you point to Pac-Man, which was another one that everyone cited as being a reason for the crash. But they were good examples of the problems that existed that caused the crash to happen.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Did you ever actually play E.T. for the Atari 2600?
I owned E.T. the Extraterrestrial for the Atari 2600.
Did you beat it on hard?
Of course I did. there was no hard, but yes, I did beat it.
Did you get all the DLC?
Joe, you might have a unrealistic view of what the video game market was like back in 1983. No, there was no downloadable content.
What a shame.
Yeah.
Okay, well, what's the next item?
So, also in April, the FCC announced it was developing new rules for the internet, now that, you know, their last ones had gotten struck down. But these rules would essentially say that carriers could charge content providers for premium speeds. Now, net neutrality advocates were protesting those rules because they were saying, here's the problem. You've got carriers, service carriers, that are also content providers. And that's a conflict of interest. If you are providing content as well as the service to deliver that content, then what stops you from giving your content preferential treatment and slowing down everybody else? So anyone who's your customer is clearly going to go with your content because they can't get anyone else's. Like that's one of the big arguments about net neutrality is that without it, you have the cards stacked against you, especially for service carriers that also have either relationships with content providers or they themselves are a content provider.
Right.
They opened up.
Got everybody watching Comcast Tube instead of YouTube.
Right. That's legitimately or Comcast instead of Netflix or Hulu or whatever. That's a big issue. And in fact, recently it was revealed that there were lots of people left comments on this. Like the FCC opened it up to comments on the internet. And we'll talk a little bit about that a little bit later. But recently it was revealed that more than 340,000 comments, against this proposal were mysteriously lost or not counted. And that a huge number that some argue were generated from special interest groups that were pro, let's tier the internet and charge these different devices.
Oh, like on accounts that had just been created and it was their only post.
Yeah, essentially that kind of thing. But anyway, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. Moving on to May, Target CEO Greg Steinhoffel stepped down in response to the 2013 data security breach that compromised the personal information of 70 million customers.
Ugh.
So yeah, another, I mean, it was a half year after that had happened, but the damages were still rolling out. And so he accepted responsibility, stepped down. I mean, this again is one of those things where in hindsight, it's very easy to say, well, clearly their security was not sufficient. At the time, it's a lot harder to say, you know, oh, well, we need to shore this up because we're vulnerable. Unless you are actively using white hat hackers to test your security and everything is being really put to a rigorous test, it's hard to say how, unless you're just being incredibly lax. I don't know that anyone was arguing that, but still, real world repercussions for that beyond the 70 million customers who had their data stolen. Also in May, a European court ruled that Google must delete personal data when asked. And by personal data, they specifically meant links to other existing sites on the internet, because Google doesn't own the pages that it links to in most cases. It's a search engine. It pulls up links in response to a query. So the argument here was that, in fact, it was brought up by a guy who, when you searched his name, I think it was like an old court case from the 90s was popping up as the top result. And I think it was something about him not making a payment or something along those lines. And he said, this happened a very long time ago. It's completely resolved. It has no bearing on my life anymore. And yet, if people search my name, this is what pops up. So it can still negatively impact me, even though I've resolved this many years ago. So this brought up this concept, the right to be forgotten, the right to have things in your past fade away. If you have done your work in paying off whatever that thing was, let's say that, you know, you had to go to jail for something, but you did, you served out your sentence. You did everything you were supposed to do. You come out reformed. You are trying to start a new life. And yet if people search your name, that's the thing that pops up. It's obviously going to continue to impact you. So there's something to be said about that. The problem is that the European court system said, well, Google, you now, if you ever get a notice saying, I want this removed from your search results, you have to respond to it, which opens up the doors for a couple of things. One, Google will never not be doing that. That will be the only thing Google does. Like, there'll be a department dedicated to it because it's just a huge undertaking.
Right. I'd imagine most of these requests also will be without merit.
That's the other issue. That's the other one, is that if the request is for someone who doesn't want a negative thing that is possibly still very much relevant to show up, what's the criteria? How can, let's say, a company that's being criticized for some sort of perceived or otherwise malfeasance, like how can Google determine whether or not a request is legitimate or if it is something that's just trying to whitewash the background?
That also seems like you'd have people who would be very against this because they might own the content. Mm-hmm. So you could have somebody petition Google to undercut tremendously their traffic.
Yeah, which then impacts the bottom line of whatever that site is. So if you're, let's say you're a whistleblower site and, you know, you're providing an actual valuable service. You're not trying to publish things that are unfounded. You are doing your due diligence as a journalist to make sure that the things you cover are as reliable as you can possibly be expected to prove before publishing. And then you get the links removed, and then that could mean that people, one, they don't see it, so there's important information that's not getting out there. And two, you are no longer able to make a living. And now, you know, you're effectively being censored at that point. So this is still an issue that's going on right now, where they have not really resolved the problems around the demand. So everyone has some valid arguments. The question is, what's the implementation going to be so that it doesn't cause more harm than good?
Yeah, it's tough. I kind of think we're just kind of, I mean, it's not nice, but we are past the age where we can expect things to be forgotten.
Yeah.
We're an unfortunate transitional generation who did not grow up with the expectation that everything we did would always be remembered, but that's kind of the reality now.
Although you could argue also that we're very fickle as well, and things that probably should stick with us longer can very easily get dropped in favor of other things. That's some commentary about like some hacks, some reveals, some leaks of information that were big, big deals that then got eclipsed by other stories later on. That has nothing to do with any active censorship or anything. It's just human nature, the way we can very quickly change our focus from one thing to another. Now, that doesn't mean that in posterity, like we won't, like years down the road, say, look, we need to really look at this. That's still a possibility. But in the 24-hour news cycle world, we very quickly leap from one big story to another. So sometimes the best way to make people forget is just don't bring it up. Like, just let it go and it will be forgotten. Well, it's been a full story since I talked about hacking. So let's talk about hacking.
Another hack.
eBay announced it was hacked and that users should change their passwords in May. Oh,
that'll keep you safe.
Yeah, yeah. Also in May, Google unveiled a prototype driverless car that essentially just has a start button and a stop button for controls with a top speed of 25 miles per hour. There was like a little bit, I think a few more than 100 prototypes that they were going to build from scratch. Like these were not converted vehicles. These were little tiny smart car looking things. And I guess you pair it with a Google device, like an Android phone, and you tell it where you want it to go. And it takes you there at a top speed of 25 miles per hour.
Pretty awesome.
Yeah. But no brake, no accelerator, no steering wheel. You completely hand over control to the car.
Wow. Well, that kind of contradicts something I know I've heard you say before, which is that you think cars like this are always going to have manual override.
I think when they come to market, because obviously these are prototype cars that are being tested internally.
Right.
Well, I think when they come to market, they'll have to. I think that, and by have to for two reasons. One, I think that consumers are going to demand it. There's going to be a very small population of consumers who are going to feel comfortable completely handing over control of a vehicle to a computer. And then two, I think legally, I think legislation will be passed where it'll still require manual control to be a possibility.
Yeah.
I don't think you will ever get to a point, at least not, probably not within my lifetime, where cars can be sold that do not have a manual option at all. So, but that's a guess. So,
got a couple of Apple stories, right?
Yeah. Yeah. One at the end of May, that's when Apple bought Beats Electronics for $3 billion.
Well, I guess they decided that was a correct amount of money to pay.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's about the price of what, like three of their headphones, so, right? Did your headphones ever work, Joe? You got a pair of Beats, right?
I got some Beats. Not to bash Beats, Beats are beautiful, but Beats may be beautiful, but my Beats, there are no Beats.
That's terrible. See, mine works so well that I've been, we got a whole bunch in our office. When our office moved to where it currently is, but won't be for much longer, we moved into a big open office environment, which meant that we're all sitting right, you know, elbow to elbow with each other. And so we all got, the company bought us Beats headphones to kind of help us have our own, like, little sound space.
And hatchets to keep in our desk drawers.
Yeah, which is very worrisome because I sit right next to Robert Lamb and he's hatchet happy. But at any rate, my Beats were great. I'm sorry that yours never did. What color did you end up picking?
I think green.
I got red.
Color of cash.
Well, moving to June 2014 and another Apple story. Apple, actually, a couple of things that happened in June, but Apple introduced Swift, which is a new programming language for iOS and OS X development.
Nice.
I should say OS X development, not OS X. But yeah, it was a new era of programming here. And this was the time, June's when Apple holds the developers conference and Google holds the I/O event. So I didn't write down all the news that came out from that because, a lot of it doesn't have a direct impact on listeners necessarily, at least not yet. And they tend to, you know, we tend to look at the product releases more than just the corporate announcements of here's some new, you know, developer stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Also in June, the FCC opened up the discussion. This is when they specifically asked for public comment, and John Oliver did a segment about net neutrality.
I watched that, and it was great.
It was fantastic, wasn't it? He does a really good job of laying out what the issue is and why people should care about it. I love John Oliver's segments. And he urged people to leave comments on the FCC site. More than 45,000 people did so, so much that it actually brought the site down for a little bit.
Cool.
And that was just the beginning. There'd be hundreds of thousands of comments left over the next couple of months.
I'm sure they were thinking, if only we could give preferential treatment to traffic going to the FCC site.
Yeah, right. Like, you know, in a year, this wouldn't have been a problem. Well, also in June, despite facing resistance in lots of markets, something that's still going on today, the car service Uber was valued at $17 billion.
Wow.
Part of the sharing economy. Then we also, in June, had the computer chat program that emulated a 13-year-old boy from the Ukraine.
What was his name? Eugene Gustman?
I believe so. I think you're right. It was supposed to be a 13-year-old boy from the Ukraine. It was actually a software, artificial intelligence program, fooling one-third of the judges at the Alan Turing Festival, which led lots of people to say it passed the Turing test, although others were quick to criticize that claim, saying that it caused people to set their expectations lower than perhaps otherwise because it had a lot of qualifiers, right?
On one hand, I think obviously this is a very smart piece of software, but on the other hand, what I read about it suggested it's kind of tricksy.
Yeah.
Like it uses some very clever tricks on the part of the designers, but it's not really, it was tricks that actually helped them avoid the necessity to create really super robust AI.
Well, yeah, because it's a non-native English speaker communicating in English.
Yeah.
At the age of 13, meaning that there is a limited experience of the world.
Didn't get all kinds of cultural references and
right.
stuff.
Right. So by limiting the references that it would understand and the context that it could understand, they end up setting the questioner's expectations lower, and therefore the bar is lower. This is different than if you had an artificially intelligent program that was supposed to be a native speaker in whatever language you're using and to be relatively aware of most things. You're at the same sort of stuff the average person of that culture would be aware of. And to have a conversation, a meaningful conversation with that. It also raised a lot of interesting discussion about alternatives to the Turing test, right? You know, this idea that the Turing test is not necessarily a great test for artificial intelligence.
We did a podcast about that over at Forward Thinking.
Yeah, you should definitely go check that out if you're interested in this subject. That Forward Thinking episode was a lot of fun. And all of our podcasts are gathered at fwthinking.com. So if you like that kind of discussion, definitely go check that out because that was a blast to talk about. Also in June, Amazon introduced the Fire Phone, which
I'm going to pretend I care about.
Yeah. You'd be joining the millions of people who did not flock to the Amazon Fire Phone.
I think I just failed at pretending.
You know, it was one of those that, like, the idea is interesting. It really is supposed to appeal to the Amazon Prime members, people who buy a lot of stuff on Amazon. The process of buying things would have been a lot smoother on this phone than on other devices. It had a lot of interesting innovations as far as like,
so much easier to just pour the money out of your wallet.
That's pretty much what every mobile device is all about, Joe.
Yeah.
But yeah, this one was supposed to also have like a lot of cool features in it that would, allow for, better depth sensing with the camera, that kind of thing. But yeah, it just never really made a big impression. Also, just an interesting little note, Harley Davidson introduced a prototype electric motorcycle, which kind of, I guess, defeats the purpose of buying a Harley if you can't rev it and make that really obnoxious noise. I say this as someone who really would love to own a Harley Davidson. It's true.
I did not know that about you.
There's a World War...
I have seen you in black leather jackets, but I also believe you don't drive vehicles.
I don't drive cars. I don't drive cars.
But you would drive a motorcycle.
Absolutely, I would.
What a strange person.
You can have a way more situational awareness on a motorcycle than you can in a car. But you do have to worry a lot more about your safety. You have to, as motorcyclists will say, you have to imagine that you are invisible. So you have to be hyper aware of the cars around you, obviously. But there's a World War II era Harley Davidson that I absolutely would love to own. And I wrote the article on howstuffworks.com on how choppers work, and that was fantastic. I loved it. Anyway, last story for June of 2014, we found out that in 2012, Facebook changed how the news feed displayed to some users as part of a psychological experiment, and people got upset about it. You remember that story? Did you hear anything about it?
Of course, yeah.
This idea that they wanted to see what the psychological impact was if they tweaked the news feed so that certain types of stories would show more than other types.
Like, can they make you more depressed?
Yeah. And people got really mad that they became unwitting guinea pigs to this psychological study that happened 2 years previously.
I was hoping that my news feed would make me depressed in random ways.
Yeah.
You were directing this.
I thought you were just, I thought all my friends were emo, and it turns out you were just making me think that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it anytime Facebook makes any sort of change, it's guaranteed to upset people. But this in particular, with people not feeling like they were uninformed and that they were unwilling participants, really got to it psychologically.
There was some big tech company news in July, wasn't there?
Oh, gosh. So remember Sony had announced earlier in the year that they were going to cut 5,000 jobs, and everyone's like, ooh. Well, that's when in July, Microsoft announced plans to lay off 18,000 employees.
That's just crazy.
Yeah. It was the largest number of layoffs in company history for a single layoff at any rate. And Nadella, the CEO, said that the plan was to streamline the engineering operations and management processes and reduce the levels of management to, quote, accelerate the flow of information and decision making, end quote. And most of those jobs were in the Nokia division. They had Microsoft had acquired Nokia.
Mm-hmm.
And now they were getting rid of a lot of middle management largely. So, yeah, it was not a great day to be at Microsoft, I think. I'm sure anyone working there on that day was very much on the edge of their seat. And not all those layoffs happened at once, obviously. They rolled out over time. Then there was this news story that ended up getting passed around, became a little viral, that I thought was hilarious, largely because I knew the people involved. So I've got a friend. Her name is Veronica. Veronica has a husband named Ryan. And Veronica had gotten on the phone with Comcast, a Comcast representative, and she wanted to cancel her service with Comcast.
Hold on, let me transfer you to somebody else.
Yeah, it wasn't even that. It got worse than that.
I heard it.
Yeah, she handed, after she got frustrated, Ryan, her husband, took over the phone call, and at that point started to record the conversation he had with the Comcast representative, in which the Comcast representative took every opportunity to try and stop them from canceling their service. And it ended up getting pretty absurd.
It was hard to believe it was real.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people were saying, like, this is staged.
Yeah, it's
got to
be
real.
It's got to be some sort of.
Because every single time the guy would just say, oh, I want to proceed. Can we just please end my service? He would come back at him with something else. Like, you know, can't you just tell me why?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like,
it was
a really needy breakup.
Yeah. Right. Right. I swear it could change. So this ended up leading to Comcast delivering an apology to Ryan and Veronica, saying that that was not the way customer representatives were supposed to respond to calls. Then later, there were other customer representatives, mostly anonymous ones, claiming that, no, they're pretty much, you know, encouraged to take every opportunity to discourage you from ending your service.
Like, that guy was doing an awesome job.
Right. Like that guy was essentially doing what he had been told to do, or all the incentives point you toward doing. Like, you would get incentives that would be based on customer retention, that kind of thing. And so anyway, it became this whole story about corporate culture and the way that companies handle customers. And it was interesting to me just because I knew the people who were involved. And I actually chatted with Veronica about it later, and she's like, yeah, I didn't expect that to end up snowballing the way it did. At any rate, also in July, Foursquare would split into two services. one that would remain named Foursquare and one that was called Swarm. And the check-in ability, where you would go to a place and, you know, you normally would go to Foursquare and check in, that went with Swarm, which left a lot of people asking, what the heck is Foursquare now?
I'm going to say that I always thought, what the heck is Foursquare? Now, I mean, I understand what it does. I just don't get it.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
That I totally understand your confusion. I loved Foursquare for two reasons. I loved the idea that, one, other friends who used Foursquare would be able to see if I was nearby and maybe we could end up hanging out.
Hmm.
Never worked out, but that says more about me than Foursquare. The other was that Foursquare, you know, some places that would allow you to check, or some places that had a presence on Foursquare would have specials, like special deals, like check in three times, get a free appetizer at this restaurant, that kind of thing. And my wife and I go to enough of the same places where that ended up being something cool and we like doing it. But neither my wife nor I use Swarm. I tried it. She didn't even bother. She just deleted Foursquare and was done. I tried it and then deleted it. Not enough people were using it for me to care at the time. It may be different now. And Foursquare became more of a recommendation engine. Like,
mm-hmm.
You are in this neighborhood. Maybe you would like to have coffee here, that kind of thing. But I don't know how their numbers are doing right now, but I do know the initial response was negative.
I think Foursquare should have done a thing where only four people can check in at a time, and then there's a line of other people waiting, and one of them is king.
Yeah, and yeah. Manufactured exclusivity has become an incredibly popular tool. So, you joke, but that could probably work.
Jonathan, I just realized we've been talking for more than 50 minutes, and we've only made it halfway through 2014.
Yeah, yeah. Who would have thought that boiling a whole year down to an hour would be a hard thing to do? You know, you make a good point, though, Joe. If we were to continue on at this pace, obviously this would be the longest episode Tech Stuff has ever done. So
I'm sure you've had some long ones.
Yeah.
But I think we should just make the second half of the year another podcast.
That sounds good to me. So we are going to wrap up here, and in our next episode, we'll pick up in August 2014 and talk about what happened during the second half of the year. So guys, if you have any suggestions for future topics for Tech Stuff, let me know. Send me an email. That address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com, or drop me a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Tumblr. The handle at all three of those is techstuffhsw, and we'll finish out 2014 really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.